It may not feel like it now in North Florida, but winter migration is underway. We're recording this in late September, still over a month away from the peak, but I was looking at the BirdCast migration map just this morning and the numbers are starting to pick up. The Florida Panhandle is a destination for overwintering birds, and the coming months are a prime time to birdwatch. That is today's topic. This is Coast to Canopy, an ecology podcast from WFSU Public Media. I'm Rob Diaz de Villegas. Joining us in the studio are Julie DeGremond. Julie's on the board of directors for the Appalachian Audubon Society, an Audubon chapter serving the area roughly between the Osceola and Apalachicola rivers and the Florida Panhandle. And you also write blogs for them as well, right?
Yes.
And you're the field trip leader.
Yes.
Yes. All right. Well, welcome, Julie.
Thank you.
Don Morrow volunteers at the St. Mark's National Wildlife Refuge serving shorebirds and ducks. You do the shorebirds twice a month-ish. About once a month for ducks. Yeah. And you also write this great birding report that you can read on the Friends of the Refuge website. Welcome, Don.
Morning.
So I want to start with that bird. So I was just looking at the migration map this morning. It seems like it's really picking up. Do you guys keep an eye on that BirdCast or any of the migration maps? And does that affect like any of your planning of outings? I
check BirdCast every morning just to see what's going on. There are mornings when I'm feeling lazy and I get up and check. Like last week, I got up and 1.7 million birds had crossed Leon County.
Wow.
And it was bolt breakfast and head out the door.
Yeah, same here. It's coffee and BirdCast every morning. So, yeah, it's a good predictor. And like Don said, it can change what I'm going to do in a day.
Gotcha. So for our listeners who aren't familiar with it, it's kind of a neat thing. It's the network of weather radars, and they can detect the density of birds. And it's, 1.7 million birds obviously will show up on a radar. So that's kind of a neat thing. I want to talk about, I've gone out with both of you on outings at different locations. And so I want to talk, Don, I've been out with you on the refuge, and Julie, we were out at Lake Jackson at a couple of different spots. So.
Yeah.
So in the coming months, what can we expect at either location? Want to start with Lake Jackson?
Sure. Well, we've been in drought, and so the lake has been steadily dropping.
Yeah.
Lake Jackson is known for the sinkhole that's in it, Porter's Sink. That sink periodically opens up and the lake drains, and when that happens, we get a lot of mud flats. So right now, the lake is looking pretty low, and I'm hopeful we're going to have that event happen again in the next few weeks.
Yeah.
Aside from that, it's always good because there's water there. It's also a great habitat. So around this time of year, we're going to be looking for migrating flycatchers to show up there. Falk Landing is a wonderful location for flycatchers. We've had we get alder flycatcher every year. Currently, there's one there now. We get least flycatcher sometimes. Last year, I think it was last year, we had a brown crested flycatcher, which is a rarity from the West, very uncommon. Ash-throated flycatcher is another one that can be a visitor that we're on the lookout for. And also, because it has a good mix of habitat with hardwood trees, brushy undergrowth, willows, lake, mudflat. You can just get any variety of birds there, and there are warblers that will be passing through, so I'm looking for those, as well as the birds that are highly associated with the water, like egrets, herons, ducks, shorebirds.
Right. White pelicans show up every once in a while?
They do. I haven't seen any for a while, but they have been on the lake many times, and, they're in the area.
I guess it was a couple years ago we shot that segment. They were out there in pretty large numbers at that point. I remember that.
Yes, they were.
So, Don, I know the refuge gets really busy in the winter. What can we expect in the next couple of months?
Well, right now we are really building up with shorebird migration. Shorebird migration starts very early, with Arctic shorebirds starting to move through as early as July. Right now we've gone from winter, when you have a couple of species of breeding shorebirds and some over-summering yearling shorebirds, the birds that don't migrate in their first year. And you probably have maybe 150, 200 shorebirds on the refuge in early July. Yeah. I did a shorebird survey this week and had over 1,000, 17 different species. So shorebirds are starting to stream through. A lot of these birds are long jumpers. Some of these birds have been flying for several days, may have taken off from North Dakota. They'll land here, species like pectoral sandpiper. They'll feed for a couple of days. They'll bulk up. They'll end up weighing 50 to 75% more than their normal weight. And then they'll take off, and they may land in Suriname. They don't only jump the Gulf of Mexico. They see it as a minor impediment. They keep going until they run out of energy. And we're just starting to get into duck migration. We only have one breeding duck on the refuge, wood duck. They're there year round, and we get Yankee wood ducks coming down in the winter. But right now we've got blue-winged teal moving through. Blue-winged teal are the odd duck. They're long-distance migrants. Most blue-winged teal are wintering in South America, some as far south as Brazil. And those blue-winged teal are now moving through the refuge. Because they are just stopping and then jumping again, the number of blue-winged teal on the refuge changes every day. I had three yesterday, and I had, I think, 45 2 days before, but it can jump up to a couple of hundred birds, and it can go down to almost nothing. Our big rush of migrant ducks starting to come in will come in and starting in late October. And then in November, all the ducks come down, and the duck population will jump from next to nothing, a handful of wood ducks in July, up to several thousand ducks from November through the beginning of February.
And that's a combination of ducks that are stopping and staying, and then also moving on?
Right at the beginning, there are still some ducks that are moving on.
Yeah.
Northern shovelers, a lot of them are going down to the big islands in the Caribbean, Cuba, Hispaniola. But starting in late October, we're getting the ducks that stick. A lot of ducks are only coming down this far. And so we'll end up with 23 species of waterfowl, you know, visible on the refuge over the winter period.
Just for our listeners listening to the podcast, we're talking about a lot of different bird species that we have footage of. So if you are a visual person, you can check out the video version of this podcast on the WFSU Ecology YouTube channel. And then also we put this podcast on the WFSU Ecology blog, where we'll have photos of these birds as well. So we've talked about specifically so far Lake Jackson and the refuge. As far as the winter months, what are some other kind of cool places we could go within sort of 100 miles of Tallahassee?
Well, there's no shortage of those.
Yeah.
You know, it just depends on what you're looking for. This time of year, well, as we move into winter, we're going to have sparrows, so we'll be looking at grassy areas as well. Tall Timbers is known for that, and that's kind of a longleaf pine wiregrass habitat there. And the National Forest is another good spot for that. We have a lot of different lakes. So for me, I'm always looking for areas that have water.
Yes.
Pineasy, Lake Lafayette Heritage Trail is a really great birding spot. You know, if you wanted to travel some, then, you know, there's everything. Well, St. Mark's is always a good place to go. I frequent Bald Point, which is in Franklin County near Alligator Point. That's a fantastic migrant trap there. You'll get a lot of raptors there. So I've had days where I've had like 50 or 60 kestrels and 10, 15 merlins and a couple of peregrine falcons, as well as the warblers and regular residents that are there, shorebirds and such.
Yeah. And I'm glad you mentioned raptors. And in some of these coastal areas. It's, I think for some people who are listening who might be really getting into birding, like, you know, warblers can be a real challenge and a lot of the smaller birds, but, you know, going out and seeing raptors and wading birds and oyster catchers at Bald Point, especially, that's a lot of fun there and on the oyster reefs. That could be a big obvious thing. You could see that it's a cool looking bird and you get a sense of, you know, birds in the habitat, in a nice, well-preserved habitat. You guys both kind of visit certain spots repeatedly, correct? Mm-hmm. And there's certain spots you have your favorites and you've been going for years. Does that, you think, change you as a person to go to a place over and over again, a natural place, over seasons, over years? I don't know. How does it get you in tune, I guess, with sort of a lot of our rhythms here in the area?
Oh, well, that's definitely true. That's one of the things I love about birding is it is seasonal. And, you know, as the seasons change, we start thinking about what's going to be arriving or what's going to be leaving. And, of course, you look at just how everything ties together, the trees that are losing their leaves or that have berries. Like when I see a good elderberry bunch growing, I think, yeah, I got to remember to check this spot later when those are ripe. And you know that that's going to draw things in. You know, when I see like an insect explosion of some sort, then I'm always thinking, okay, yes, this is great. This is going to bring the birds in. And you just kind of see how all those things mesh together and work together. And, you know, the changes in season means a change in birds, which keeps it fresh and different. And when you go to the same spots over and over again, you get an idea of what's going to happen. You know, just like I mentioned, the alder flycatcher at Falk Landing every year in September, we get alder flycatcher at Falk Landing. So when I'm thinking about what am I going to see, then I think, okay, I got to go to Falk Landing in September and try and suss out that alder flycatcher.
Yeah. It's really cool to go to places that you don't normally go to head out to bird someplace that you've never been before. I've been to Alaska looking for birds, and certainly I see things that I will never run into if I just stay in the Big Bend area. But if you bird the same place over and over again, you get a sense for the seasons and how they're changing. It's very common to say there are no seasons in Florida. And that's absolutely not. You know, the seasons are a little bit more subtle. We don't get 12 inches of snow coming down to signal that it's winter. But you can watch how winter comes on and what winter is down here. You know, all of the naturalists that did famous writings, Thoreau, people like that, all lived in New England, and right. They are New England-centric, and that's what we're taught seasons are. Seasons are colored leaves, snow. Spring happens, you know, at a short period of time, and summer for them is a short period. For us, it's 6 months of the year. Yeah. But it, you know, if you bird the same place over and over, you get a real appreciation and a real sense for how things change slowly and subtly, but continuously.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that about the seasons in Florida. I'm a big native plant person, and also I'm big into insects. I like to watch bees and other things. And you know, at that level, you could definitely see there's almost, you know, at that point, 20 different seasons in Florida, the succession of blooms and different insects that emerge at different times. And then when you factor in bird migrations, I know when there's a certain time of year when the hooded mergansers land at a pond by my house. And then that's a thing I mark, you know, as a seasonal marker of one of the, you know, 20 seasons in Florida. So let's talk a little bit more about the what else is indicative of a Florida winter as far as things that we could see when we're out birding or just in general.
Well, I'll tell you one of my favorites. So the thing I look forward to every winter, this is actually at my house, so it's not a birding hot spot yet, but the hummingbirds.
Oh, yeah.
So growing up, my grandmother actually said to me, take down your hummingbird feeder or the hummingbirds will stay and then they'll die. because they'll freeze. Mm. And so I grew up believing that you had to take down your hummingbird feeder at, you know, a certain time as fall approached. And that's actually incorrect. So the winter here in Florida is one of the best places for hummingbirds. I get regular rufous hummingbirds and black-chinned hummingbirds that overwinter at my house. I know multiple people that have other birds that are considered rarities here in our area that overwinter with them hummingbird-wise, like buff-bellied hummingbird or calliope hummingbird. And if you don't have your feeders up in the winter, you're not likely to have them, and you might happen upon one passing through, but you're not likely to have them overwinter with you. And that's something that, talking about how you look for the birds to return. So my hummingbirds are banded, and that gives me information that they're the same birds. And just this year on September 12th, I had one of my banded hummingbirds return to my house. It's a female ruby-throated hummingbird, so not one of the rarities, but she spends the winter with me. And the second that bird showed up, I knew it was one of my previous birds because she went to a spot and she was like, hey, this is my spot. And she started bullying the other hummingbirds. And so immediately I made notice and took pictures of her legs and got the band number and was able to get that information.
Gotcha. The hummingbird migration just sounds kind of impressive. If you think about a bird that size and how far it flies, right? That's pretty cool.
They are Transgulf migrants. Uh-huh. Tiny little, ounce and a half bird is taking off and flying for 600 miles across the water. I can't do that.
Yeah. You mentioned banding, so I want to follow up on that. So talk about that process. So I know you do a lot with shorebirds, so you probably see quite a lot of banded birds down there. So explain for people what banding is and how it's done.
Okay. Well, it's done different ways depending on the species of bird. So with the hummingbirds, we actually they have a system where they use a bird cage, and the feeder is put in the bird cage, and we use a rod and reel, essentially, and hold the door open. And when the hummingbird goes in, we close the door. And then the bander takes the bird in the hand, and he takes measurements. He looks at everything from, the molt and growth of feathers, the measures the bill, weighs the bird, and puts a tiny little band on its leg, and all of this information is written down and put into databases. Another way that it's done is when birds are chicks. So with like the snail kites that were recently nesting in Leon County, when those baby birds were getting close to fledging age, the banders took the babies out of the nest, did all of those same processes, made measurements and wrote down different markers that they look at, and the bands were put on their legs. And in that case, two of the babies, they actually put GPS tracking devices on, and then they're put back in the nest.
Right. And then so for a lot, especially for migratory species for banding, like down at the refuge, you get a lot of birds that are flying from different places in the country. So as on that end of it, where you're there sitting there with binoculars, talk about that part of it and the information we get from banding on that end of it as a person who's watching where these birds end up.
Well, you should always be watching for bands. It's a good best practice for birders, and especially with the advent of powerful cameras, you can read the color bands, not necessarily the aluminum band that the Fish and Wildlife Service puts on the bird with a long number on it. That's pretty small. That's hard to see. But a lot of birds will have color bands, and it's with some, it's the combination of colors. They're set up so that you look at the upper right or the upper left or the lower left or the lower right, where the colors are, which colors are on top, which colors are on bottom. And that's a unique combination with some of the larger birds. I had an American oyster catcher on Lighthouse Pond last week that had a band on both upper legs. And with a lot of birds, they'll have a band. It'll be the same number on each side. And this one had three letters, one above the two. And since they're both the same on each leg, you're looking at it and you can piece together more easily what that is. And I wrote it down, and it was a colored orange band, and I called it into the American Oyster Catcher working group and found out that I had an American Oyster Catcher that was banded at Jacob Riz Park in Queens, New York.
Wow.
On the nest last summer in 2024. It had been found one time before, about a month ago, down in Cedar Key. So that bird had flown down to spend the winter along the Florida coast, dropped in at Cedar Key, and for some reason decided, not so much, and flew up to St. Mark's. Where it goes next, I don't know, but I'll be able to follow it on the American Oyster Catcher webpage.
Right, and there's different organizations that do different species of birds. I remember I was on a shoot with Florida Audubon at the Phipps Preserve on Alligator Point. We saw a piping plover mm-hmm. with bands, and they rode into FWC to find out. So when I released the segment, I could say where it came from. And so it was from the Great Lakes. And so we knew that bird had migrated down from the Great Lakes to spend the winter here on the our coast here in Florida. And then so let's describe those bands a little bit just so people know. It's these little plastic bands and one metal band usually, correct?
Yes.
Depending on the species, right? And they're this very small, lightweight plastic, and they should not impede how the bird functions at all in the wild.
Correct. And there are different types of bands. For example, I once found a turkey vulture that had a tag. And this was like a big orange tag with a number that was on its wing. Yeah. And you could see it from a distance. You know, it caught my attention immediately, like, what is going on here? And as Don mentioned, I carry a camera with me. So anytime I see a bird that has a band, I work hard to get the band. I actually used to go on shorebird surveys at Phipps, and there we would be documenting the piping plovers and snowy plovers and American oyster catchers. All of those birds there would frequently have bands, and we would be collecting that information. Another way that birds are banded I wanted to mention is misnetting. So, you know, I mentioned the two with specifics, but with just migrating birds, often they'll put up a net that the birds can't see. They'll fly into it. They'll then take that bird in the hand and do all those measurements and put the band on them. And sometimes they'll do that targeting specific species. Right. And other times it's targeting, you know, finding out what's passing through that area. So, yeah.
Yeah. We have footage of that, too, that we'll edit into the video version of this podcast with Jim Cox a lot at Tall Timbers does that with several species. We have him banding that way. And I'll just mention that is something that requires training and a permit to do.
Absolutely.
Definitely when you're handling birds, small birds especially, and he bands chicks, he bands birds that he nets. So, that's definitely an activity to be done cautiously. All right, so you talked about going to Alaska to see birds. I know I've been on vacation sometimes in different places in the summer and seen birds that come here in the winter, and they look a lot different. I remember seeing a really common bird we get in the winter is a yellow-rumped warbler, and they look a certain way when they come here, and they're fairly colorful even when they're here in the winter. You still see that little bit of yellow on the rump. But when I saw it in Colorado, I saw, man, that's a really elaborately colored bird.
Yeah.
So talk about when birds come here, how do they look different than they do and why than they do over the summer in their summer areas?
Most birds have two plumages a year. They have a breeding plumage that's really brightly colored that the presumably male yellow-rump warbler that you're talking about seeing was in his breeding plumage. He wanted to look good, wanted to be impress the ladies. But then you want to come down the rest of the year. You don't want to be nearly as bright because if you're brightly colored, you're going to attract predators and you don't necessarily want want to do that. One exception to that are ducks. Ducks need to be in breeding plumage to attract mates, but ducks do their mate formation in the winter. And that's why the ducks that you see down at St. Mark's in the winter are all nice, brightly colored and look like they do in the bird book, because they're in breeding plumage. They come down here generally in most species as individual birds. They mate up, and when they fly back as a pair. They then go through a molt after they finish breeding, and some of them are still in a drab alternate plumage when they first come down here. Right now, any blueing teal you see does not look like the book. It's just a brownish little duck because they haven't finished molting yet. They won't finish molting until probably October. But most of them are already in, have already molted again into their breeding plumage before they get down here. But most of the winter birds you see are going to be drabber than they do, than they look like in breeding plumage. You want to see them looking really good? Look at them on spring migration. That's when you don't have confusing fall warblers. You have striking spring warblers.
Right. And I think I've seen that in the yard even with the yellow-rumped warblers right around May or so, before they, I guess, they're leaving, they start looking different. I remember when early on when I was still learning about, and I'm still learning, or always learning, I guess, just noticing, I thought that was a different bird. I'm like, oh, no, that's the same bird. It's just molted. Yeah.
There was a post one time in spring that someone had put up saying that the goldfinches had just arrived. And actually, the goldfinches had been there all winter. The goldfinches had just molted into their golden plumage. In the winter, they're drab, greenish, little sparrow-like birds.
Talk about identifying birds that way, too, because a lot of them start looking really similar because they're all so little and gray. And I mean, obviously, if you have a high-powered and if you have the knowledge, talk about the challenge of IDing a winter plumage bird.
Well, I think it's kind of just like you were saying about warblers. People sometimes have a tendency to stay away from warblers or sparrows because the fact of the matter is that's part of birding, is looking at the finer details. So you just train yourself to look for, you know, different things. Like you always look at what color are the legs? What does the bill look like? You know, I personally like when birds are molting and they look real ugly. I just find that humorous. You know, that's what I think of when you start talking about the yellow-rumped warblers. Before they get beautiful, they get really ratty looking and patchy. And so, you know, just looking at the structural part of the bird versus the plumage. Plumage can be a key. I went to actually it was a book signing, but the guy was talking about identifications, and one of the things he really recommended was not looking at the plumage, not looking at the colors, and really just looking at almost like the shadow of the bird. And there are different guides have different keys like that where they show kind of just a black outline of the bird and kind of becoming familiar with the shape of that bird. Of course, we're human. We can't help but look at the plumages and the colors, and those things are going to be keys, and they do tell us things. But, you know, when you see something that looks funny, like a ratty yellow-rumped warbler, then, you know, I personally like to just study it and look at it and kind of think, okay, what is it, you know, what stands out to me? That lets me know what that bird is. Of course, with that particular bird, it's going to always have that yellow rump, regardless of what plumage it's in. So,
right. I've heard it said that Roger Torrey Peterson ruined birding for people. He had his system with key field marks, and so there would be a little arrow that pointed to something, and that caused people to look only at the key field mark. And like Julie says, there are other things. There's the shape, there's the behavior, there's the microhabitat that birds are in. I tell people that you should be able to identify a yellow rump warbler without seeing the yellow rump. That's not necessarily the best field mark on it. And if you really start looking at birds, it's like anything else. If I decided to learn wildflowers one time, because I figured, hey, it can't be hard. There's blue ones and yellow ones and white ones. You know, and you start looking and you go, oh my gosh, you know, there's so much detail in here that you can pick up on that you don't see until you start looking. And, you know, think of music. You know, if you listen to music with somebody who is a musician who really understands, they understand that music. They see or hear much more of what's going on. And if you want to be a birder, start looking at birds. There's that detail, that wealth, that richness in there that changes all those birds from little gray jobs or little brown jobs into, you know, very distinct individual species.
Right, right. Both of you just reminded me, I visited the Cornell Lab of Ornithology one time, and they have this giant painting on the wall and saw silhouettes, and they say, well, that's, you know, that's the first thing you want to look at is that shape and not so much the color or whatever else. I want to shift now to sort of the experience of going out and bird watching. So when I went on both my shoots with each of you, I met you at 6 in the morning at the refuge.
Yeah.
We met at 7 o'clock at Lake Jackson. You'd already been there for about an hour or so, already birding. So, you know, talk about, yeah, when's the best time to start?
Well,
go for it.
I mean, my answer to that is the best time to start is when you have the time. So whenever you have the time, that's the best time. That being said, I find that it is very productive and also enjoyable to be where I want to be before the sun comes up. And as the sun is starting to come up, you see all kinds of bird movement during that hour. But also, that changes throughout the day. You go through cycles. So I find that like around 10 in the morning is a time that it seems like birds kind of pop up, and I know that as birds are migrating, they migrate at night, and they come down in the morning, or they don't, but 10 in the morning is another time that it seems like, and that's just a rough time, not by the clock, you know what I'm saying, but around that time, you start seeing other birds showing up that weren't there before. And, you know, I think there's something to be said for almost every time of day, though.
Yeah, if you look at, you know, birds, some birds, you know, night birds, you have to be out at night. There are birds that are crepuscular. They're more active at dawn and dusk. Rails are that way, although they will walk out in the middle of the day. And then there are birds that are tidally influenced. If you want to see shorebirds at St. Mark's, get a tide table and look at the tide table. At high tide, all those birds are pushed in. At low tide, as the mud flats and sand flats all along the coast are exposed, they've got plenty of places to feed, and they're going to spread out, and you're going to have a hard time finding them. I set all of my shorebird surveys at St. Mark's up for a 2.5-foot tide, because 2.5 feet is at the mouth of the St. Mark's River is the magic number that covers all of the mudflats and pushes everybody into the interior ponds. If you go to Tower Pond right now, if you go on a low tide, there's virtually nothing there. You may have 20 or 30 shorebirds sitting in there. If you go at high tide, you could have a couple of hundred right now. And in the middle of winter, you could have a couple of thousand.
Right, right. And I love that you're talking about the movement of water, because I thought that was interesting at Lake Jackson, interesting on the refuge. I think all of our waterways in North Florida have this, you know, sometimes it's a daily kind of flow or more of a seasonal kind of a ebb and flow of the water. And, you know, it's so dynamic, and that's a big part of the birding, isn't it? Because I guess that changes the habitat and exposes new food sources and covers up new food sources. And
right. And you have to watch for things that are happening off of a regular cycle. If you go down to Lighthouse Pond right now, it's loaded up with foresters' terns, with a whole range of waders, egrets, herons, roseate spoonbills. And the reason is that the water level there is dropping. It hasn't been raining. There are dead fish. There are fish that have very little oxygen, so they're not moving fast. And with the same number of fish and less water, they're concentrated. And so that is like a cornucopia for those birds right now, and they've all moved in. And you know, so you look for things like that too. Certain species, wood stork, for instance, are famous for flying, you know, 30, 40, 50 miles in the day to look for a pond with the water level dropping, because that's the easiest and best place for them to feed.
Wow. Wow. And then so another thing I want to talk about too is when you're out at 6 in the morning, and especially when I was out with you in the morning, we were listening more than we were watching too. And so that's a whole other world for bird watching. It's not my strength at all. There's like, you know, really obvious bird. We were talking about red-winged blackbirds earlier. That's an obvious call. That's easy for me to hear. But talk about that aspect of it, learning the bird calls and how much that enhances what you can understand about birds in the area.
It's very important. And sometimes you're sitting there with several thousand dollars worth of optics on you going, why do I have these? Because what you're getting most of your birds by hearing them, by hearing calls that are out in thickets, in the night. If you want owls, I rarely see owls, but I get owls. I had four owl species the other morning and didn't see a single one. So it's a very important part of birding. And we have now tools like Merlin a free app for your phone that you can turn on. Merlin's very good. It makes mistakes. You have to be careful. Either that, or I actually heard a mute swan at the Double Bridges down at St. Mark's one morning. So every now and then it will hallucinate and just come up with something just out of the blue. But most of the time you can turn Merlin on, and Merlin would tell you what you're hearing.
It's a fantastic app, and a lot of people who aren't even really serious birders use it. It's really interesting to see how many people I meet that go, oh yeah, I have this app that tells me. And it, like Don said, it's a fantastic tool, but it is also a tool. So just like if you have a hammer and nails and wood, that doesn't make a birdhouse. You have to put work to it. So you need the human part of that equation. That's something that we see on eBird, where people who are not real experienced will frequently report something simply based on Merlin. I always encourage people to not do that. You want to make sure that you know what it is you're listening to. And Merlin is a great tool for that, because you can hold it in your hand and see when it picks up a bird, and you can key in on what it's picking up. It also does have where you can play that bird's call and listen to it and go, yeah, that is what I heard. Or, no, that wasn't a screech owl. It was actually an ambulance. You know? Birding by ear is very important, and there are a variety of birds that can only be ID'd using their call. For example, I found a Couch's Kingbird here in Leon County, and that's a bird that it's a Western Central South America bird. Looks just like a tropical kingbird. They look virtually identical. There are some really small identification keys, but it's really hard to separate them that way. But their calls are completely different. So it became very important to hear that bird call in order to get the correct identification. The alder flycatcher at Falk Landing is another great example. I actually followed that bird around for something like 10 hours trying to get it to call, because without the call, I really couldn't report it as an alder flycatcher. I had to go with Trails, which is a mix of alder slash willow, because those two birds, again, there are some very small identification keys that some people are able to accurately key in on, but it's so subtle that I've spoken with people who ban birds who say in the hand they cannot tell them apart. So having that call is going to be really important. For me, I am not the best person at identifying birds by call. I know a lot of the basic ones because I hear them every day and I do key in on them. For me, it's more if I hear something and I don't know what it is, that's important. I'm like, whoa, what is that? Let me go check that out. Let's hunt it down, take a look at it, and see if we can figure out what it is.
Yeah. And as a geriatric birder, Merlin's hearing is better than mine. And one of the things I use Merlin for when I'm out walking is to hear birds that I can't hear and alert me to the idea that there's a Parula warbler somewhere around here and I should go looking for it.
Right.
And so then I know to look. If I hear if it hears an oven bird, I know to look low. If it hears a Parula, I know to look high.
In that regard, some of what you're saying sounds like Merlin is a little bit like iNaturalist, where if something's really rare or unexpected, maybe it's not going to identify it, or maybe sometimes it comes up with an out-of-the-blue identification that doesn't quite make sense for an area.
Yeah, I'll throw another scenario at you also. So I have a mockingbird at my house, and I can hold Merlin open and look at all the things it picks up when he sings. He is very good at doing a bald eagle, mm-hmm. a killdeer, a great crested flycatcher, Mississippi kite, Carolina wren. And here's the kicker. He does a tropical kingbird.
Wow.
So that's not really a bird that we have. In fact, a tropical kingbird has never been reported in Leon County that I'm aware of.
You kind of touched upon eBird. So now I want to delve into that. So
okay.
eBird is cool. In two different ways, I think, for someone who might be getting into birding, but one of them is that it collects data. Since it's collecting data from so many people, it kind of lets you know where a lot of things are and can direct you there, and so there's hotspots, and I want to talk about that. And then I want to talk about just that collection aspect of it, too, since, you know, I use iNaturalist, and it's all photo-based, and the quality of the photo, obviously, you can verify that a lot more easily. So talk about how eBird works and sort of maybe how there's some pitfalls there, some traps.
eBird is a citizen science project. Turn on your phone. You can do it afterwards. You know, keeping notes. But most of us use a phone app. You turn it on when you start birding. You note the birds that you see. The best practice is you note how many birds you see, not just that you saw the bird. You turn that in. If you're turning in something that is questionable, a Delhi penguin, for instance, it will light up in a second and ask you, are you sure? And it's very possible to see a rare bird. Happens all the time. Merlin also will flag birds that are out of season or out of range, and that happens a lot. And all you really need to do is put in a good explanation, explain what you saw, how you made that identification, turn it in. That gets reviewed, and the sighting will be accepted or not, depending on how well you do. I looked at an explanation one time, somebody who claimed they saw a mottled duck down at St. Mark's, which is a good bird to get at St. Mark's. And the explanation was, I know it was a mottled duck because I was with somebody who knows mottled duck, and they said that's what it was, which doesn't impress me unless you tell me who that person was. If it's Julie, great, I'll accept it. But, you know, that just gets thrown out. But Merlin takes all of those sightings, puts them together, and that's how we advance science. That's how we see how ranges are changing. That's how we see how many birds should be in an area. It's a great thing. It's worth the effort.
Yeah, and so you mentioned Cornell Lab. So Merlin, eBird, BirdCast, all of these things, it's very multifaceted. They all work together, and they're all run by Cornell. So the information that we put in is reviewed by them and used by them. Scientists use it. It's a way that we can really have an impact. And just yesterday, I had someone send me a message. They were in the backwoods of Georgia, and they said, American coot is rare here. And I said, well, I've never heard of the place that you're at. So probably I'm guessing it's highly underbirded. And so I said, you have a unique opportunity here to have an impact and share information that they don't have yet. So do your best. And so with eBird, it is a fantastic tool. If I meet a birder who doesn't use eBird, I encourage them to use it. There's so many different bits of information that you can get from it. You can look up a place. You can look up a species. Let's say the alder flycatcher. I can type in alder flycatcher. It's going to give me the top pictures of alder flycatcher. It's going to give me an overview. It's going to show me range maps. And then I'm wondering when can I see one here? So I can change the location to Leon County, and it will then give me a bar chart showing me, you know, when they have been seen in our area. It'll also show me the local photos and sound recordings of that bird. The photo database is very valuable. So if I'm trying to familiarize myself with a bird and I want to really get to know it and I don't have the opportunity to sit for hours with that bird and watch it myself, that's a first step that I can take. For example, in November, I'll be going to Cuba. So I go to eBird, I look at Cuba, I go to the hot spots, I look and see what people are seeing. I go to the different species that are listed on those eBird checklists. I click on that species and then go through a whole litany of photos, not just the top photos. Top photos are great. They show you the best look of that bird, picture that could be in a magazine, very clear, concise, and typically beautiful. But right. If you go to the other photos, you get more of what usually when we see a bird, it's not going to be as gracious as that and just sit there and go, well, here's my wing bar, here's my, you know, yellow leg, or, you know, here's my side view. You know, they're usually going to be fleeting glimpses. You're going to get bad looks at times. And so it can be really valuable to look at those bad photos and say, okay, that's this bird. And, you know, it helps you familiarize yourself with them. Also, eBird, let's say the three of us go birding right now, we do an eBird checklist. Don has his camera, I have mine, you have yours. We all take pictures. Maybe I make some recordings on Merlin. And then when we end our checklist, we can all add our photos on there. I can put my Merlin recording on there. Let's say Don saw a peregrine falcon, but we had our back turned, so we didn't see it. So he adds the peregrine falcon. While he was looking at that peregrine falcon, we're looking at a white-winged dove over here, and Don didn't get to see it because he was watching the peregrine falcon. So we put our white-winged dove on there. When we look at that checklist, it's almost like a scrapbook of that memory. I'll go, oh, yeah, remember that time me and Don and Rob were birding and we saw that white-winged dove, but Don saw the peregrine falcon. And, you know, I look at the pictures. So it's a fantastic personal tool in that way. And, you know, the information is all reviewed by reviewers who can decline your report and make it obsolete, or they can confirm it. And then it goes into the database, and when people look to see when was a peregrine falcon last seen, oh, well, this morning by Don Morrow, they see that. There also are rare bird alerts that you can register to get, and that will go right to your email and let you know, oh, this morning Don Morrow saw a peregrine falcon at WFSU, and someone who wants to see it can go to that location and try and locate that bird themselves.
Yeah, I'll be going out to Arizona next month. My son lives out there. And what I'll do is I'll turn on the rare bird alert for Pima County, Arizona, when I go out. I'll be birding while I'm out there. But if something really rare shows up, I don't want to get home and then read that somebody had had seen a bird that I really, really want to see later on. So I do that anytime I'm going on a trip. I'll turn on the rear bird alert for that area, turn it off. I keep the rear bird alert for Leon and Wakulla counties on all the time just to see what's up.
So speaking of the rare bird alert, so every once in a while we get something out of the ordinary here in the area. And it'll be marked on eBird. So was it the white wagtail a couple years ago? And then that was found. And it was registered. And then people started coming to see it from outside of the area, right?
Correct. Yes. Actually, I found that bird. So it's very special to my heart. One of my favorite birds that I ever found. And yeah, that was that's another point that I like to make, especially to non-birders, because my goal is always to inspire people to care about the earth and the natural world and try and preserve as much of it as we can. That particular bird, definitely over, I would say, 600 people came to Leon County just to see that bird. There were, you can go in eBird and see how many reports there are, and there were also people who actually don't use eBird that did come. I spoke to people who came from, you know, as far as Kansas and Kentucky. And it's hard to remember because it's been a couple of years. Yeah. But I met a lot of people from different states that actually saw that bird reported. And one of the things about birding is that we love to collect lists, like Don mentioned. Like he probably has an idea of Arizona, his Arizona list, and then his life bird list, just birds that he's seen in his life, or his United States list. We all kind of keep lists, and birders get very serious about that at times. We will travel long distance. We'll spend a lot of money. We'll go to an area. We'll pay to stay in a hotel. We'll eat in their restaurants. We'll buy gas. We'll stop at their convenience stores and spend money in the area. And so, yeah, that's a part of it.
Birding has a significant economic impact. If you look at St. Mark's, you know, one of the things I do in the winter, you look at the license tags that you're seeing license tags from all over. And you're seeing people coming in just to do birding normally. They'll go out. Wakulla is not on the main line to anywhere. Yeah. But they're staying in the area. They're buying food. They're buying gasoline. Rare birds start pulling in more people. The white wagtail, the flamingo that stayed at St. Mark's. I ran into some folks at St. Mark's, and we walked out. We found the flamingo. At the time, it was hanging on one of the back ponds. And so I said, you know, where are you guys from? And they were from Cleveland. And they had left work Friday night, traded off driving to get down to St. Mark's to get the flamingo. This was on Sunday morning. They'd missed it on Saturday. And they said, boy, we're sure glad we don't have to do this drive again. And I said, did you do it before? They'd been down the weekend before on a long drive, missed the flamingo, went back, worked all week, and then drove back down to get the flamingo again. Yeah.
Yeah, and then the flamingo had some friends after a hurricane, right? So storms sometimes mix things up, and birds just end up flooding into the refuge and other places.
The pink wave came through.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so we have. You mentioned something a little earlier. I kind of want to talk about it too. So just over time, sort of maybe birds shift their range, or we just get things like storms that kind of make things interesting for a little while.
Yeah.
So talk about what's happening at Lake Munson that you've seen some interesting new residents, perhaps.
Yeah. So. Last year, I did find a snail kite at Lake Munson, and that's a really good rarity to have in Leon County. They're actually non-migratory. They're nomadic, so they move around, but they don't actually migrate. Anyway, I know that that's a great location for them because the invasive snails are prevalent there. It's actually probably the very best place in Leon County to see limpkins.
Oh, I saw a bunch of nests earlier this year, actually. I got some video of that. Yeah,
awesome. Well, limpkins are another snail specialist, and they're a bird that has really bounced back due to the invasive snails. Snail kites are a federally listed species. They're endangered. There's somewhere around 3,300 of them in the United States, primarily in Florida, pretty much all in Florida, originally called the Everglades kite because that's where they were found. They have expanded their range due to the native apple snail becoming less prevalent and the invasive snail being more prevalent. Another factor for snail kites is that they are, again, back to the water. They really need somewhere around 13 to 15 feet of water to nest in. Lake Munson happens to be hitting that sweet spot. And in April, when I went there, I found a pair of snail kites, a male and a female. This immediately got my mind thinking, hey, there's potential here. And a few days later, I brought a large group of people there from Orange Audubon, actually, and we witnessed them mating. So that was very exciting. We witnessed it. We photographed it. Another woman that was there actually videoed it. And then the next day I came back and witnessed them starting to nest build. So I did contact the Snail Kite Project in Gainesville. They track the snail kites. They document them. They help keep the check on the numbers, how we're doing. And this pair of snail kites expanded into three snail kites. And there was a female that was not a part of the pair. Originally, because it was the male that was nest building, we thought it was the original female, but it was actually a different female that was staying primarily hidden on the far side of the lake. The Snail Kite Project came out. They checked the nest. They said, yes, there are three tiny babies in there. And they came back about, I don't know, a month and a half later, pulled the big babies out of the nest, banded them, put tracking devices on two of them. These are tracking devices that make use of cellular technology, and they can literally call the bird's number at any time and find out where they're at, and they have maps showing their movement. This was a groundbreaking event because prior to this, the furthest north that snail kites had ever nested was in Gainesville. And prior to that, it was 150 miles south of Gainesville. So when the Snail Kite Project people came and FWC, they worked together, they did tell me that the snail kites were missing from Gainesville and they wondered where they had been. And there were also three snail kites located at Miccosukee Greenway here, which they're still some present there. I haven't spent as much time there, but I've spent a lot of time at Lake Munson watching the pair. They successfully reared those three babies, which then fledged and have been seen periodically here and there. I'm not sure whether they've left the area now. They may have. They were anticipating that they'd hang around for about 3 weeks and then fly around and look for a good place to go. I know that they were here much longer than that due to their bands and their trackers, so I have seen them since then. That pair re-nested and successfully reared three more chicks, which then fledged, and I watched them learn how to fly, learn how to hunt, and I still periodically see them around the lake. And then the male took up with the other female on the far, far side of the lake where I can really barely see them. I did see them nest building. I saw that there was behavior that looked like they were nesting. FWC did come out and check it and said, yes, there is a nest there and it looks active. At this point, I don't know whether they successfully reared babies in that nest or not. But you can still go to Lake Munson and see snail kites there. So, it's pretty exciting.
Yeah. So you've mentioned over the course of this podcast, the Snail Kite Project, Oyster Catcher Project. So uh-huh. if for a layperson who might see something kind of interesting and they don't know, there's seems quite a lot of organizations they might contact, would it be maybe smart to contact Appalachia Audubon first and then
sure,
get the direction?
That's a great resource. And, you know, good old Google can tell us a lot of stuff.
Google banded birds, if you see a banded bird,
right.
And you can work out where to send the information.
As we start wrapping up here, I want to talk about, so if we have advice for people who are just getting into birding, we live in a spot where there's quite a lot to see.
Mm-hmm.
So if we were to give advice to people starting out, you know, they don't have perhaps any optics, they don't have any, you know, where to go, what to do, what's the first step to get into birding in this area?
There are field trips available through different groups, especially through Audubon. And what you should do is go on a field trip. Go on a field trip with Audubon, go on a field trip at St. Mark's. Often you can find loaner binoculars that people will do. When I was a kid, I joined Audubon at 11 years old. I did not have binoculars. I relied on walking around with people and having people feel sorry for me and go, here, and hand me their binoculars so I could see. But you want to bird with other people. You want to bird with people who understand the context, who can get you started. And we are coming up on the best time of the year to bird. The winter season, first it's cooler, you know, it's cool weather and it's hot birding. Bird diversity is highest in the winter. It's 50% higher than it is in the summer. And the total number of birds is a lot higher. There are probably five times as many birds here in the winter as in the summer, primarily because we have a lot of flocking birds. A lot of the sparrows, the ducks especially, you know, are here in large numbers. We don't have Parula warbler here in the winter, but it's replaced by yellow rump warbler, and yellow rump warblers love to get together with a couple of hundred of their best friends. So,
enemies.
You know, their birds are easier to see, and there are more variety of them. So we're coming up on a good time to go birding. Go find somebody who knows how to bird. You're leading a field trip tomorrow, I think?
I don't think I am tomorrow. Tomorrow I'm doing a trash pickup, so I hope not.
Okay.
Go pick up
trash with you.
Well, this will air after that, but there are trash pickups in a lot of different locations throughout our area, so you keep an eye out for that too. Yeah.
Audubon does that as well. But you can go to the Appalachia Audubon Society website and just go to outings. We have a lot of regular outings. We do Birds and Brews, which is kind of a social outing where we might meet at a location where you can get a drink or food. I personally don't drink, but I go to them and get something to eat, and we do a little bird walk. I will give some additional advice to someone getting started birding. This is kind of old school, but buy a field guide. Get a field guide for your area and get to know the birds that are in your yard. Spend time looking at them, identifying them, and that's a very good starting place. You can see a lot of stuff just in your own backyard. And I agree with Don. I think having someone that you can bird with is really valuable. I did not have that. I went to an Audubon meeting when I was in my 20s, and it was all a bunch of older men. No one spoke to me. I felt very out of place, and I never went back. I remained on a member of Audubon. I supported the cause, but I didn't go to those events because I didn't feel like I felt, you know, welcomed. I wasn't unwelcomed. I just didn't feel really welcomed, and I felt uncomfortable. So I did the majority of my birding throughout most of my life by myself and through books. Later in life, I started going on birding tours, like in Arizona and the Everglades and Belize. And those group outings taught me so many things. In fact, that's how I learned about eBird, is going on a birding tour. And, you know, that opened a lot of doors for me. I wouldn't know all the birders I know now if it weren't for eBird. In fact, I wouldn't be in the Audubon Society. I wouldn't be on the board of the Audubon Society. eBird really just opened so many different doors for me. So I definitely recommend create an eBird account, play with it, you know, get to know the birds in your area, and then also join some bird walks.
And you're talking about backyard birds. And so in the winter, there's some really easy things to see, like flocks of robins and cedar waxwings that are interesting looking. They have interesting behaviors. I know they make a real ruckus when they get to the cherry laurels by my house. So that's an easy thing to see. And Merlin picks up pretty easily as well if you're not sure what it is. Last question. So winter's going to end in a few months. We don't just get visitors from the Arctic up north. We get South American visitors. So what are some of the things that we'll expect in the spring to come visit us?
Well, spring migration is a very exciting time. It's a faster migration than fall. Mm-hmm. Birds are interested in getting up and grabbing the best breeding sites. Plus, they are in their best plumage. We'll get probably 47 species of birds coming through here that we won't see any other time of the year that are just pure migrants. They don't nest here. They don't winter here. And so spring is the time to go out and see them at their best.
Gotcha.
And anytime there's migration, anything can happen. You never know if you're going to find a white wagtail or a Couch's kingbird or something else that's not expected to be in your area ever. So just keep your eyes open, get out there and have a good time.
Yeah, yeah. And we do get some things that migrate here to nest, right? Like swallowtail kites nest in the area or no?
Oh, sure. We definitely get stuff that migrates here to nest.
There are about 35 species that breed here that come into to nest from South America.
Yeah.
Summer tanager, orchard oriole, the Perula warblers come up. They're one of our earliest migrants. They start showing up in February. So there are a lot of birds that are here only in the summer, but there are almost twice as many birds that are only here in the winter.
Gotcha, gotcha. Yeah. Wow, this was a really fun conversation. Thank you guys for coming in. Don Murrow, Julie DeGremond, and this has been Coast to Canopy. In the last hour, we've talked about limpkins, shorebirds, bird banding, Lake Jackson, the St. Mark's Refuge. You can see what we're talking about on the video version of Coast to Canopy. You can find that on the WFSU Ecology YouTube channel and at wfsu.org/ecologyblog. The Ecology Blog version has additional photos and links to several stories on birds and birdwatching in our area, as well as stories about the locations we talked about. All of this work is made possible by viewers and listeners like you. If you want to support this podcast and the other ecology work we do at WFSU Public Media, you can join the WFSU Seed Circle. This is a new thing we've been doing for just a couple of months now. You can join for a $10 a month donation, and we'll give you a shout-out on this podcast for a year, if you want. And now for the shout-outs. Thank you to David Blair, Carol Goodyear, Chris MacFarland, Carrie Maddox, Clara Mullins, Alina Pryor, Kim Sash, and Donna Tharp. You can join the Seed Circle at wfsu.org/ecologyblog. This has been Coast to Canopy, an ecology podcast from WFSU Public Media. Today we had Taylor Cox running audio, Jason Acuna and Ian McGordy handled video, and Ian McGordy digital video post-production. I'm your host and producer of all things ecology at WFSU, Rob Diaz de Villegas.